You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello and welcome to Dots.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and as the dulcet strains of Ludwig von Beethoven inform us once again, we are back on the air with Connecting the Dots. We are here every day at this hour to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're here on this first Thursday in Lent with our good buddy, Mr. Douglas Francis Aloysius. O'Brien.
Patrick O'Brien.
Douglas, you just have to maximize the Irishness of the name. It's
That's right.
You know, there was, I saw a thing, apparently it's like a deal in some parts of the country. It's like a big thing because St. Patrick's Day is going to fall on a Friday this year.
Yep.
And so there's like pressure to get the bishops to authorize, you know, the eating of corned beef for St. Patrick's Day. And I personally hate corned beef with the white hot passion of a thousand suns. I loathe corned beef. So it's like, I don't care, you know, if they authorize it or not. But for some places where there are a lot of Irish who care about these things, that's like a thing. There's also, on March 16th, apparently, there has been a move afoot for a few years now by Finnish Americans to promote something called St. Urho's Day, U-R-H-O, the Finnish saint who, according to Finnish Americans and very recent legend, drove the crickets from Finland.
Thank God.
Yeah, it was a problem, I guess, crickets in Finland. But yes, apparently he used the awesome incantation Hennesirka, Hennesirka, Menetasta, Hiten. Finnish people out there can correct me, perhaps, on my pronunciation of Finnish. But apparently that means grasshopper, grasshopper, go away. And if it's not true, I just don't care because I want it to be true. And so
much more effective than Deconner raid, no doubt.
Yes, no doubt. You know. Well, you know, it's I just want to believe that there was, first of all, that there was a St. Urho. I've never actually even verified that. And that he drove the crickets from Finland saying that, because I just think that that's so cool. It's as good as, you know, Patrick driving the snakes from Ireland. You know, there aren't any snakes there, and that proves that it worked. So
that's right.
Yeah. So
well,
that's
can't sleep with those crickets chirping all night. You know, I could see that being a problem.
Yeah, and you know, and with climate change, they could come back too. So
that's right.
They may show up, make it across the border from whatever Finland is across the border from.
Russia.
Because is it okay? As an American, of course, I am proudly ignorant of my geography. So I couldn't tell you the first thing about Finland, except that it appears to be somewhere near Russia, according to an important source who I hear from on the show every Thursday, who tells me these things. So
well, we
got to
talk about this corned beef thing, because I'm with you on that. I am a proud Irish Catholic, and yet I am not a fan of corned beef. I mean, I'll eat it. Anyway, and it's not even fully Irish.
It's not?
No.
What?
No.
I thought this was like the
funny thing about that.
That and the potato.
Yeah, no, well, the potato is, well, it's also not really Irish. It's from Peru.
It's actually from Peru. That's right.
But corned beef is because when we came to this country at the turn of the century, many Irish, the second big wave of Irish immigration, they frequented urban ghettos where there were large populations of Jews. And they shared the same stores and shared a lot of culinary habits, and corned beef became associated really with Irish Catholics in the Northeast, and it kind of spread around the rest of the country.
But we stole it from Jews?
We did. American Jews. Irish Americans stole it from Irish Jews. From American Jews.
From American Jews.
Right.
I had no idea. You know, there was a really interesting three-part series that was done by Ken Burns, the guy that did the series on the Civil War some 25 years ago now. And he did one more recently on Prohibition and talked about, the first part of it talked about the reasons for Prohibition, which are actually were very, very powerful reasons for Prohibition. When you look at the rate of alcoholism in the 19th century, it really was a noble experiment. It was a huge failure, but you can see why they did it. And one of the things that they talked about was once it was instituted, there were exceptions for, among other things, religious rights. So Catholics were not, although there was a very strongly anti-Catholic component to Prohibition. And American opinion on Prohibition tended to break down very strongly along Protestant Catholic lines. Mm-hmm. Catholics all thought it was crazy.
As it was.
And it was, you know. But, you know, a lot of Protestants saw it, among other things, not only as, you know, a war for purity and virtue, but also as a struggle against Romish influence. Mm-hmm. And nonetheless, when it was authorized, there were exceptions made for religious uses of alcohol. So Catholics were not denied their communion wine, nor were Jews denied their uses of wine for their various religious rites. And one of the things that was done during Prohibition to get around the Prohibition was to sign yourself off as famously, you know, things like Rabbi O'Shaughnessy.
Yeah, right.
And
hey, it could happen.
Sure, why not? Well, it turns out, you know, when I think of Prohibition, I think when most people think of Prohibition, you know, they think, for example, of the, you know, the mob warfare that happened in Chicago.
Chicago, right.
Because of, you know, Al Capone, another great Catholic. And, but it turns out that one of the biggest and most successful bootlegging empires in the United States was run right here in Seattle, which I did not know.
Nor did I.
I had never heard this story, but there's this whole story. And it started with a Seattle cop who was sent up the road to a little town that's about 5 minutes from where I live called Edmonds. And he was sent up here to stop a bootlegging shipment that was being sent off, because we had a really great geography for bootlegging, because all the major cities in Western Washington all sit right on Puget Sound. So you just load up the boat and you just go right up the coast, you know, and just offload.
Wonderful distribution system.
It was a fantastic distribution system. And so this Seattle cop came up here to bust somebody, and he looked around at this operation, and his first thought was, I can do this way better than these clerks. So
that's American ingenuity, my friend.
Oh, right, he was there. A genius. And so, yeah, so he immediately just set up his own bootlegging empire, and he just bought off all of his brother cops in the Seattle SPD, bought, and then, you know, made a ton of money. And with that money, he bought off the rest of the Seattle government. And then proceeded to buy off most of the government in Washington State, because nobody's heart was in this.
Right.
Nobody really cared about this stuff. And we were, you know, we're far enough away from Washington, D.C., just about as far as you could get and not be Alaska or Hawaii. And so enforcement of this was really weak. And what he did different than Chicago was he absolutely forbade the use of violence by his lieutenants. He said, you know, we'll just buy people off. We won't have to shoot anybody. Just pay them enough money. They don't care about this stuff. Half of them are drinking the booze that I sell them anyway. And, you know, so it was a great American success story.
Yeah.
lasted throughout the 20s. And that's why you never heard of it. Because it didn't have all the blood and violence and St. Valentine's Day massacres and all the rest of it that went with the Chicago operations, you know. And there were no rival gangs. He basically just ran everything, and there was nobody else doing this, you know.
He wouldn't have been an Irish cop, would he?
It wouldn't surprise me. I would guess, though, that he was actually probably a Scandahoovian, because that's what everybody here was, especially at that time. When they came out here, people tended immigrants, when they came to the United States, tended to look for geography that reminded them of home.
Right.
So Czechs and Germans wound up in the Midwest because they remembered flat places, you know, and so that's where they showed up, in places like Chicago, you know. And if you read like Willa Cather's My Antonia, the Czechs all show up in places like Oklahoma, which has a town in it that's actually called Prague, because it's Oklahoma, which I just love, and Nebraska and so on. Well, the Norwegians and Swedes all wound up here in the great fjord that is Puget Sound.
Right.
And so when I grew up here, it was just Andersons and Olsons as far as the eye could see. And I will bet you that guy was a Scandinavian of some extraction. But
just so you know, every December 5th, I celebrate the repeal of Prohibition.
Well done. A truly Irish Catholic thing to do.
That's right.
Connecting the dots, your host Mark J-A-E-R with you're on Redbox Media after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Connecting the dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. And we went a little far afield last segment. We wound up talking about Prohibition and that and other great Catholic legacies to American culture. You know, if it hadn't been for us Catholics, especially German Catholics, especially brewers, who you'll notice are all... I mean, all the brewers all have German names, right? Anheuser, Busch.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, all Pabst, that, you know.
Right.
Pabst, yeah. And, you know, that is part of the Catholic legacy to American culture, is they kept, you know, breweries alive, you know. Of course, we also owe a great debt to Scotch-Irish Protestants in the hills of East Tennessee.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, also kept the production of alcohol alive during Prohibition. And there's a famous story about the guy who was buying beer during Prohibition for his speakeasy, and the customers kept complaining about the flavor. And so he suspected that the brewer might have been cheating. And so he had it sent off for analysis, and he gets a telegram back from the chemist that says, "Regret to inform you, your horse has diabetes." So, lots of great stories out of Prohibition.
There you go. Right.
But not a terribly Lenten subject. So, you know, if we want to start talking about pain and suffering, there's no more Lenten thing to do than to discuss the State of the Union address on Tuesday. That is it's a subject of pain and suffering for a lot of people. I got to give Trump credit. I said this yesterday, talking to Rod Bennett about this. I think that this State of the Union was the best speech Trump has ever given.
Yes.
And the thing is that's really not saying a lot. He didn't bite the head off of a chicken during his State of the Union address or go off script and start saying crazy things like the press is the enemy of the American people. So he sounded a much more conciliatory tone, which is to say he talked like a normal person.
Right.
And it's what I've heard one poli-sci teacher that I knew one time referred to it as the Gomer Pyle axiom of high and low expectations. That when Caruso's voice cracks, everybody sees it as a crime against humanity because it's Caruso. But when Gomer Pyle sings and it's not awful, people think it's a new Caruso. And really, it's just Gomer Pyle not being all that bad, you know. And that was kind of it, you know. You went to the State of the Union wondering if he was going to go off script and say something crazy. And he wasn't crazy. And so people were like, wow, that was fantastic, you know. And really, it was just kind of, it was okay. There were a couple of points in the speech where I actually thought this seems like a reasonable policy to try to pursue. I like the idea of rebuilding our infrastructure, for example. So, you know, good. He proposed, you know, rebuilding the infrastructure. That's good. We should do that. He didn't really explain where the money was going to come from for doing that. Did you get a sense of where the money is going to come from for doing that?
The following day, I mean, they're proposing enormous cuts, massive cuts to EPA, the State Department, and other areas. I mean, so they're looking to have layoffs, which they politely call RIFs, reductions in force. The proposal that has been leaked is to reduce the number of EPA employees from 15,000 down to 12,000 and have similar reductions at state and other agencies. But that doesn't get you there. You know, obviously that does not get you there. They are using an idea which is called dynamic budgeting, which is if you grow the economy, it builds tax receipts. And when there's more tax receipts, then you will have the ability then to pay for things. Republicans have historically opposed this dynamic budgeting idea, but they may opt in for it. But like you said, infrastructure is a good thing.
If they do it.
And I think they will. And I think, and in fairness to, I won't say Mr. Trump, because I don't think he's even aware of it, but in fairness to the Republicans, when President Obama instituted his shovel-ready infrastructure spending, many states did not use those funds as was hoped, right? And so it didn't really have the economic impact that people wanted.
Where did it go
this time?
It
went for a whole host of other things, everything from teachers' salaries to, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it didn't achieve the end, right? You know,
right.
So if you're given money to build a bridge and use it for a whole host of other state budgetary needs because the economy was tanking across the country, states had less revenues, and so they used some of that money to fill those holes. What that meant then is that you did not get the bridge rebuilt. And so here we are, 8 years later with the same problem. And
we actually had a literal bridge collapse here in Washington. Like the day before we were going to drive over it.
Right.
We go to Memorial Day weekend. We go up to the San Juan Islands, and to get up there, you have to, among other things, you have to cross the Skagit River. And the day before we were to drive over that bridge, it just fell into the river. With cars are just driving across it, and suddenly there's no bridge there.
Was anyone hurt?
No, miraculously, no one was killed. They just kind of came along and fished him out of their cars, and everything was fine. But it could have easily meant, you know, a number of deaths. But instead, you know, we were without a bridge there for several months while they figured out what to do. But yeah, it sort of brought home the whole, you know, the infrastructure really needs paid attention to, because this was a major bridge. This is on I-5, the major artery that goes from Washington to California.
But in the end, you know, whatever his infrastructure plan is that there's still the very strong likelihood that projects like you just described will not get funded, and we will continue to have projects like the Bridge to Nowhere in Alaska, right?
So right, yeah.
State-of-the-art bridge that goes literally to nowhere.
Right.
And then bridges in Seattle actually are at risk of crumbling. So,
yeah.
But again, I think you're right. That was a highlight that Democrats and Republicans can generally agree on, that they would like to see. There are obviously other parts of the speech that were, or proposals rather, that were, you know,
appalling.
Appalling would be a polite way to put it. Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I think the one we were talking earlier is that I think the issue of this victims of immigrant crime department at the Department of Justice or at the Department. Yeah. With immigration is, you know, I have never heard such a widespread audible gasp by members of Congress in a State of the Union before.
Right.
Which, by the way, was echoed, I think, in probably living rooms all across the country. It certainly was in mine.
Yes.
Just shocked by that.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it either. You know, just so we have our bearings, there was an article today in Scientific American magazine. You know, there are studies that are done of these kinds of things. People actually have data, hard data. And the data is that immigrants don't pose a greater crime risk than anybody else. They just don't. And yet, there's now going to be essentially a ministry of fear established by the Trump administration.
Well, fear and propaganda, Mark. Because
fear and propaganda. Exactly.
To promote this idea, as false as it may be.
Right. And to strike fear into people's hearts, and it's going to work, especially with his base, because his base have already convinced themselves that whatever Trump says is the truth, and any counterfactual is fake news. Any counter-Trump facts are fake news. That's just a lie being told by the liberal elite, et cetera, because they're covering up. They're just making things up. And this is actually something that Trump has said, you know, that any story essentially that makes him look bad is fake news. And you should regard the people who tell you this as liars. That's gonna be something that is bought by what the currently I think his approval rating standard about 42%.
Right.
42% of Americans are, you know, given the choice between what the dear leader tells them and what actual research shows, will listen to what the dear leader tells them.
Well, and the dear leader had about 3/4 approval rating for his speech. Right. So,
yeah,
I mean, clearly he can communicate a message no matter how inaccurate it may be.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing. Communicating lies is not communication exactly. Well, it is communication, but it's not education. Well, we'll be back after this message. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. We're talking about the State of the Union, and we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
welcome back to Connecting Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Doug O'Brien, and we are talking about the State of the Union. Here's something interesting. According to thehill.com, a recent poll shows that less than half of Republicans believe a free press is important for democracy.
Wow.
That's the party of Trump. That's where we stand right now when it comes to his supporters. They want to hear what the dear leader tells them, and they're ready to believe it. And anything contrary to that is a threat, even if it's the truth. That ought to worry us a great deal. On the bright side, 3 in 4 Democrats believe that a free press is important for a democracy. So there are still sane people in the United States. But when we're looking at the way in which people have responded to the State of the Union address, I think there's no question that the most emotional part of the State of the Union address was the honoring of the widow, Corinne, the widow of Ryan Owens, the Navy SEAL who was killed in Yemen. And it is only right and fitting that that poor woman received that honor that she got, and that she was receiving on behalf of her husband, and the thanks of a grateful nation for his service. And, you know, who could not have been moved by that? That was just an enormously powerful moment. And my mind keeps going back to that moment. It made me cry when I watched it. It was emotionally powerful, and you wanted her to receive those honors. You wanted her husband to receive those honors, and you want every widow and widower who has lost someone abroad in the service of their country to receive those same honors, because, you know, thank you for your service. And I was grateful to Trump that he quoted the passage from John where Jesus says, greater love has no man than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You know, because it connected that loss to the sacrifice of Jesus. And it told her that your husband didn't die for nothing, that, God sees. And I was glad that he did that. At the same time, there's all kinds of background to this story that was not spoken and will never be spoken by this administration. So you see, for example, Trump's weird dances around this entire topic earlier in the day. I mean, they were showing interviews that I was seeing on the web, and the weirdness of his approach to this loss. So on the one hand, it was a brilliant operation and he takes credit for that. But on the other hand, somebody else started the ball rolling on this, and it's the military's fault that he was killed, and I didn't have anything to do with that. And it's not my fault. But it was still a success, but it's not my fault. And it's like, what are you saying here? You know? And earlier in the day as well, and in the days preceding, the father of the serviceman refused to meet with Trump and wanted an investigation into whether or not anything was gained by this operation. At this point, the only person whose word we have for it that it was a success at all is Donald Trump. He says the General Mattis tells him it was a success, but he says a lot of things that you can't trust, so I don't trust him on that. He's lied too many times for me to take his word for it. And so what goes back to this is, or what this goes back to is the soldier of the man who was or the father of the man who was lost won't speak to Donald Trump. And so what happens instead? Well, Trump brought this woman whose orders she was made a widow and puts her in front of the nation for this incredibly emotional moment. And all I could think of was, you poor woman, you know, having to go through this in front of the eyes of a nation. I hope that for her sake that something good came out of this, but I couldn't help but think at the same moment that I was glad that she was receiving the thanks of a grateful nation, that Trump was massively exploiting her because she's a widow, because he made her a widow. And that really bugs me. And of course, what bugged me even more was the next day, instantly, the way this was being spun was, if you have any moral qualms about this at all, it's because you hate our troops and you hate this widow. No, I think the world of this widow and of her husband. What bothers me is the use that they were made of by a political establishment that has much to gain, and in fact did gain from it. So it bugs me.
But it should. You know, I come from a military family. My parents and grandparents served. My wife served. My children served. I have deep respect for everyone who puts on a uniform to defend this nation and the privileges and liberties that we have, right? I think everyone's in agreement there. Like you, I was clearly choked up, really not so much by the president's words, but by her reaction, right? The widow's reaction.
Yeah.
I was, like many people, troubled by the father's refusal to meet with the president. And share some of the, you know, the problem is this, is that we do not know, and we are not likely to know, what the actual effect of that raid was, right? We don't know if useful intelligence was gained and or not. There are Pentagon investigations that I think have begun or are about to begin, and any time someone puts on the uniform, they know at some level they are at risk of losing their life. And so it's a risk one takes. And I don't think any president, I was on the Hill when we passed the first Gulf War resolution to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And I will tell you, the Senate chamber was, it's an experience I'll never forget in my life, is the way the Senate members of both parties really wrestled with the decision to send American troops on foreign soil for a country that you know, we had no real ties to except economic. And it was really the first time that the Senate had been asked to commit U.S. troops at that level since the Vietnam War. And it was really gut-wrenching, and there was a somber tone. And I certainly hope that there was that kind of solemn seriousness to the decision for the Yemen raid. And I, like you, was bothered by the sense of the whole situation and being something of a prop, right?
Right.
But again, I'm going to assume that there was a much more, again, the Pentagon doesn't put our troops in harm's way unless they believe it's necessary. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the generals, and he has really a stellar foreign policy team, many of them current or former military. And so I think they would be very cautious to put people in harm's way. But again, like you, there was an unseemliness to how that played out, but it may have also been quite authentic. You know, I mean, clearly the widow was deeply moved by her recent loss, and we as a nation should be grateful for the sacrifice that she's made on behalf of all of us. So
yeah, Yeah, it was, well, it was the Trump said something that stuck in my craw. After it was just as there was a long ovation, you know.
Sure.
And by the way, both sides of the aisle were applauding her. You know, right. One of the things that happened the next morning that really irked me was like instantly the lie machine started up and said, you know, Democrats all sat on their hands and refused to applaud a widow. It was like, no, they didn't, because they're not inhuman monsters, you know.
Right.
But when it was all over, Trump weirdly said something to the effect of, you know, I think that this set an applause record.
And I thought, goodness.
Ew, you know?
Wow. Really? Right,
that was just a gross thing to say, you know? But anyway, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shane, here today. It's Doug O'Brien and Mike Koff, and we'll be back on Redbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are back, and we are talking today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. I guess we means the royal we. I'm not really sure. but at any rate, we're talking a bit about the State of the Union address. And we were talking over the break, the latest. The final analysis with the State of the Union address is talk is cheap.
Yeah.
Let's see what he does. Because, I remember one time, I think it was in his second inaugural, George Bush, took it into his head to talk about going to Mars or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was like, okay, you know, that was kind of unexpected.
Well, I got to tell you, actually, I was part of that discussion.
Yeah?
Leading up to it, yes.
Really?
We had met with the president's people, I would say, this had to be in early December of the year prior to convince the president and his folks that he should make ending childhood hunger in the United States a priority. Now, I say that, it sounds, for liberals out there, they'll say, oh, that's crazy, you'd never accept that. Actually, George W. Bush, as a evangelical Christian, was pretty good on social safety net programs. He really was
he did right by Africans.
That George W. Bush did over the same period of time.
He did right by Africans too.
Sure, PEPFAR, which is the AIDS relief program in Africa. Fantastic program.
Yeah.
So it was not out of the box, and they actually invited us to come and make the pitch, and we did. And had a very positive reception. In the end, as I was told, and this could be completely apocryphal, I don't know or not, but in the end, a political decision driven largely by Karl Rove was that was not visionary enough, and he had to talk about going to Mars instead. So,
cares about a bunch of stupid kids. They're all going to die.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway.
Yeah, I know.
But Mars is cool. Yeah, I remember that at the time and just thinking, okay, you know, Mars. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it'd be cool to go to Mars, but it just seem like a top of the list kind of thing.
All the way up until the week before the speech, we were unsure if we were in or not, right? And so it was a surprise to us too. I mean, I'll just say that it was. There was an open reception, and I guess that it's a good segue from the conversation we had earlier, which is, I think, you know, these are difficult decisions the presidents have to make, right, and their administrations and their staffs. And I think that I don't necessarily join the chorus that the Yemen raid was a bad idea. I don't think the Pentagon purposely puts people at risk unless they're certain that there's a chance of success and it's a worthwhile mission, right? But the president, I think, he was very unseemly how you overplayed this issue. And I think that's the unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was interesting. There's a Twitter feed that's worth paying attention to called Rogue POTUS Staff. I don't know if you're if you've seen it or not. Rogue POTUS Staff I'm convinced now, just because of the kind of information that they have and when they have it, that these guys really are writing from inside the White House. I just heard an article on NPR just the other day talking about technology has made this period of time in our history the golden age for leakers. It's incredibly easy to leak information now because there are like whole apps that's all they do. You know, so you can send a secret message to somebody. It's encrypted. Nobody else can possibly see it. It will allow you, for example, you'll get a message. It will have the information that you need to see. And you pass your finger over it. And the moment that you pass your finger over it, indicating that you've read it, it vanishes forever and it's untraceable and all the rest of it. Anyway, so Rogue POTUS staff has taken advantage of this, and they've been tweeting sort of samizdat. Samizdat is the word that was used behind the Iron Curtain for, you know, bulletins from the underground behind the Iron Curtain talking about what the Soviet government was doing. Sometimes, you know, leaked from prisons, for example. People who were in Soviet prisons could get information out to their friends and so forth. And Rogue POTUS staff basically does this from inside the White House. So you get all these little bulletins about what's going on inside the White House and kind of chronicling the chaos that's happening there and all the rest of it. And one of the things that Rogue POTUS staff pointed out was that Trump wasn't paying attention during the Yemen raid. He ordered it, but while it was going on, you remember that picture of the whole Obama White House crammed into this room watching the raid on bin Laden?
Right.
Trump was tweeting while it was going on. They know when the raid was happening and they know when tweets were being released because they're always timed and date stamped. And so while this Yemen raid was happening, Trump was busy doing something else, tweeting about whatever, you know. And that's the kind of thing that troubles me deeply, is that kind of inattentiveness to what he's doing and his chronic inability to take responsibility. He will take credit all day long, but he will never take responsibility. So the raid was planned by somebody else, but I take credit for it because it was a huge success, but it's not my fault that our Navy SEAL guy was killed. And by the way, not just the Navy SEAL guy was killed. An 8-year-old American citizen was also killed, along with a number of other civilians. And we didn't hear about that either.
Well, you know, they say the most heartbreaking and somber moment that any U.S. president has is when it is a tradition that the president of the United States literally signs the letter that goes to the family of a fallen serviceman. And that, you know, there are many, many stories of how that has affected different presidents, you know, in the seriousness of the office. I don't know if President Trump has got to that point yet where he's signing these letters, but at some point the gravitas of this has got to sink in.
And hopefully
he will not be so cavalier in how he's what he's doing when American servicemen's lives are at risk.
Well, something that Howard Stern, of all people, pointed out.
Oh, my gosh.
But, you know, I think Stern, I think that at some level, Stern gets this guy better than most people.
Oh, probably,
do.
Sure, because he's been on a show so many times.
Right. And one of the things that Stern has said, and I think really is true, I've never thought that Trump was like a monster. You know, he says at the bottom, he says what Donald wants is just to be loved. And I think that there is something to that. You know, he's a narcissist. And, you know, the difference between narcissism and pride is pride doesn't care what you think.
Right.
Narcissism cares intensely what you think. And so what have we seen? Well, we've seen even after the election, even after the inauguration is over, he's still having campaign rallies.
See, so you're telling me we have a 4-year therapy session?
That's what a lot of this presidency is going to be. I mean, it's about his needs. God. He's deeply needy person, you know? And when you have that kind of need, so for example, I have no doubt whatsoever that in the moment, during the State of the Union address, he genuinely felt tremendous empathy for Corinne Owens and you know, was basking in that shared feeling of love for her, and, you know, transferring it in part to himself because it's all about Donald at the end of things. But I think there is, at some level, it's that need for love and that, the pain of having to face the fact that people are, he's never been in a position where people died because of decisions that he made. And that's got to be, you know, a shock for him, and how he copes with that and how his... you know, particular psychological framework works in that. It will be fascinating to watch it play out. But, you know, for the rest of us, though, we have to deal with the fact that this is somebody who we just don't know how he will respond to, for example, a provocation that's felt personally against him. So, God forbid, a terrorist attack on one of his own properties, a Trump Tower, for example. This is somebody who will take that personally, who can't help but take it personally. He takes everything personally anyway.
Yeah, but I, you know what I would do, though? I would take confidence in the fact that the generals that he has at various agencies are men of great integrity and courage. And would absolutely resist the president and tell him no to his face. I mean, that is the one confidence I think we can have.
I sure hope so. The thing is they still take orders from him even after they've said no.
Yeah, that's true.
That's how it goes, man.
On that happy note, Mark, thank
on
you.
On that happy note, we depart. I want to thank you so much, Doug O'Brien, for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer is Danny Head, and we will be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Until then, have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.